Hi, everybody. My name is Barbara Burbank.
Hi, Barbara.
And I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And for me to say that is really something, because I came into this program kicking and screaming. I didn't want to be here. But I'll get back to that. I really thank you for being here. I thank the committee for inviting me to come. I really love North Carolina, and your southern hospitality is super, and I love to hear you all talk. Because I'm more or less of a northerner by comparison anyway. I was raised in a small town in northeastern Iowa. I was the youngest of three children, had what I call a very normal, happy childhood, felt loved, felt taken care of, treated well all my life. In fact, I always kind of thought that I was the favorite child in the family. And then I got thinking just a couple years ago that surely my brother thought that he was the favorite child because he was the only boy in the family. And so I saw my sister, my older sister, and I said to her, "Virginia, did you ever think you were the favorite child in our family?" And she says, "Yes, but I think it was because I was the oldest." So you see, they treated us all well, and we all thought we were the favorites. And that's what I call a happy home. My father drank a little bit, but not too much. It was no real problem. He never drank at home. He'd go from the store. He had a furniture store. And he'd go from there down to the tavern once or twice a day and have a beer, and that was about the extent of it. My mother was very much against drinking and taught us all not to drink. And my sister and I still don't drink and never have. My brother has a beer once in a while, and that's about the extent of it, of that. So alcohol was never in any part of my life. We had one town drunk who we called the town drunk. He was a very talented musician, and I don't know that I ever really saw him drunk. But that was all I knew about alcoholism. I went to the University of Iowa to nurses training, and at that time, which as you can tell by my gray hair, it was quite a long time ago, I don't recall hearing anything about alcoholism. Not a word. Maybe they mentioned it in a sentence or two or a paragraph, but that's probably all, if that much. After I graduated, I worked at the university for a while, and the following New Year's, I met John at a New Year's Eve party. Well, you know what happens at New Year's Eve parties. There's something to drink, always. I suppose I was the only one not drinking that night. I met John, and he was introduced to me as a seminary student. He was studying to be a Lutheran minister at the time. And he was drinking that night, and I had never known a minister that drank. And I didn't think this was, you know, this just really didn't fit in my mind at all. But I figured, well, it's New Year's, you know, and that's what people do on New Year's Eve. So I kind of passed it off that way. We kept the mailman busy for quite a while. He spent the summer with me in Iowa City. And we got married in August. I did not know he had a problem. There were a couple times he didn't show up for dates and kind of mumbled something about having a problem or something, you know. And I passed it off. Of course, when we got married, everything was going to be fine. Because I'm one of these believers who thinks that a story starts with once upon a time and it ends with, and they lived happily and got married and lived happily ever after. And I found out that isn't so. People get married and live happily once in a while. And that's whether there's alcoholism or not. So So we got married, and I had kind of a 3-year plan. I was going to work as a nurse for about 3 years while he was in seminary till he finished. And then I would start having children, and I would quit working and be a minister's wife. Well, alcohol got in the way. And, I don't want to tell his story, but anyway, he ended up as a Presbyterian minister about 10 years later. And I had my first child about 11 months later. And I just retired last year from working, which was 38 years later. So my plans are not always the same as God's. And I should have realized that a long time ago, the way things were going, but I didn't. I didn't know John had a problem until, at least as far as I can recall, until our first child was born. And I think from then on, everything went downhill. His drinking became real bad. I didn't know how to handle it. Of course, I'd never heard of Al-Anon. It was many years before I heard of Al-Anon, as a matter of fact. And so I handled it as well as I knew how. I made him promise. Every time we were invited any place, he had to promise that he wasn't going to drink too much, you know, not have any more than one or two beers or whatever, or not have any. I stayed up at night and worried and stewed and walked the floor, looked out the window until he got home, and then I'd argue with him and fight with him, and we'd go to bed, and I'd stay awake all night upset, and he'd go to sleep, and in the morning he didn't even remember the argument, and I'd be really disgusted, and I'd be hungover, and I'd feel terrible, you know, just like I'd been out all night. And I finally realized that wasn't working. So I would stay up and walk the floor and watch for him. And as soon as he drove in, then I'd jump in bed and pretend I was asleep. And then we got over all that argument stuff at night. But I still felt terrible in the morning, and I didn't sleep any better. And he'd go to bed and sleep. You know, and that sets up all kinds of resentments. I really felt quite lonely, because we had a lot of friends. Part of his drinking time, he was in the ministry already, and I didn't feel like I had anybody in the world I could talk to. Who can a minister's wife talk to about a problem like this? You know, you can't talk to anybody in the congregation. Those are your best, your closest friends anyway, but you can't talk to them. He might have to minister to them, or you just didn't want them to know about it. You surely didn't want them to fire him. And, of course, I didn't want to dare tell anybody outside of the church what was going on in our home, you know. So I thought I was the only person in the world that this was happening to, and I didn't have anybody to talk with at all. I also felt a lot of rejection, because when I got married, I thought I was going to be number one in John's life, and I found out that I wasn't. I was at least number two, and alcohol was first. So I tried everything I could in order to be number one. I waited on him hand and foot, and anything that he might want, I saw that he had it. Of course, nurses are trained to anticipate the doctor's needs, and I anticipated every need that he might have. And would jump and run and get whatever he wanted and make life as sweet and nice for him as I could, thinking that somehow he would love me more if I did this. But it didn't seem to work. I call him now a male chauvinist pig. But I tell him I made him that. Because I did everything for him. He didn't have to do anything. I took care of everything for him. So if he's a male chauvinist pig, it's my fault. Between seminaries, when he was working, I used to call the boss. Of course, you've all done this. All you Al-Anons have done this, I'm sure. He always had the flu, and he should have died of the flu long ago, because every time I called, he had a bad case of the flu again. But I did every little thing that I could to help him keep his job or whatever the situation might be. I also had a lot of self-pity. I really felt sorry for myself because I was going through this. And, of course, John is quite outgoing and always has been, and people just loved him, and even when he was drinking, and they would come up to me and they'd say, "Oh, Barbara, you're so lucky. You've got such a nice husband. You're so lucky." And I think, "Oh, if you only knew." And, of course, I wouldn't say a word. I'd just say, "Yeah." Well, now I think I am lucky. I really am lucky. I do have a nice husband. But it took me a while to really realize that. And yet I never really thought about leaving him. I threatened to leave many times. One time he was counseling at a youth camp. And it was so nice and peaceful there without him. And he was going to be there about 10 days, and I wrote to him, and I told him this just could not go on. I had had it. And I was trying to tell him, you know, you got to quit drinking. But he thought that I was going to leave him. So he came home from the camp, left the kids there, you know, with the other counselors, and he came home to be sure that I was still going to be there. And made his promises again, and so everything was all right until, of course, camp was over and everything was right back to where it started. And this is the way I went. I always made these threats and never carried through with any of them. But I was always hoping that somehow he was going to change. I didn't need to change. I was okay. He was the one that was causing all the problem in our home. I was just really ambivalent too, because I loved John, and yet when we'd get out in public, I'd tear him down in front of other people, just in little remarks, you know. And I didn't realize I was even doing this. And a lot of times we'd get home and he'd say, "Why do you always down me in front of other people?" And I'd say, "John, I don't do that. I love you." And this would happen over and over and over. And I don't know how long I was in Al-Anon before I realized I was doing it. And I caught myself doing it and realized how much of a habit it had been. And I guess I just figured this was the only way I could get even at all, because I had to hold so much inside. I didn't dare get angry, because if I got mad at him, he would get mad back, and that meant another drunk, you know. Every time he lost his temper, it was another drunk. And so I tried so hard not to let him lose his temper. And if he did and went and got drunk, I'd, "Oh, what have you done now?" You know, I was just condemning myself all the time because it was my fault. I said something wrong. I used the wrong tone of voice or whatever. I was so ambivalent, as a matter of fact, that shortly before he quit drinking and got into AA to stay, he decided he was going to control it. And he was going to have 2 drinks a day. And this went on for about 5 days, and about the 5th day, our younger daughter, we have 2 girls, as a matter of fact, our younger daughter was in high school at the time, and I said, "Becky, do you suppose Dad really isn't an alcoholic after all?" And she just looked at me and she says, "Oh, Mother." And she walked away. You know, the terrible, disgusted sound in her voice, that how could you think such a thing after all this time? Because the girls were convinced. And I was trying so hard to think maybe it wasn't this after all. I got so that I couldn't even make decisions on my own. I was in my 50s before I even voted the way I thought I should vote. Believe that or not. I always figured he was up more on what was going on in the political scene, and he was very verbal about it. And I thought, you know, one thing, and he kind of thought something else, but I figured, well, he probably knew what was best, so I voted the way he thought I should always. And I believe, I was trying to figure, I think I was 52 at the time, and I had been working as a psychiatric nurse in Indianapolis there for a number of years, and I went to vote after I got off work that day. And I pulled up in front of the voting place, and I sat in the car quite a while, and I thought, well, now, let's see, I know how John thinks I ought to vote. However, and I thought about the different candidates. You know, you should do this long before it comes voting day. But I was hashing it over in my mind then, and I decided, doggone, I'm going to do what I want to do. So I went in and voted what I wanted to vote, and I'll tell you, I came out of there, I felt like a new person. I couldn't believe the feeling I had that I had done my own thing for the first time after all these years of voting. I kind of became a nobody, you know, as far as not making decisions. In my own mind, I was always John's wife. Always John's wife. What is more anonymous than that? Or the minister's wife. You know, never Barbara. I was never Barbara. I was always John's wife or the minister's wife. And that is so anonymous, and it's just so, you know, you're just a nobody. And that's how I felt a lot of the time. I finally was introduced to Al-Anon. A lady invited me to go. John had been in and out of AA for a number of years, and at the time he was sober. She invited me to go to an Al-Anon meeting, and we had to go 20 miles to get there. So I went with her, and I did not like it. I didn't need to be there. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. He was the alcoholic, and why should I waste my whole afternoon in going to this meeting because he's an alcoholic? You know, I was just a ginnet from from the start. And I enjoyed the ladies. It was a nice bunch of women. But I didn't, obviously I didn't hear anything that was said. I never went back unless she asked me, and I couldn't think up a good excuse. She didn't belong to our church, so I could always use the excuse that I had a meeting on that day or something, you know. But I did go back a few times, and I enjoyed it. I got the Odette book, and I heard them say you should have a sponsor and you should read the Odette book every day, and have a meditation every day, go to meetings at least once a week, go to a lot of meetings, things like that. I didn't do any of those things. I didn't need it. I was too good for that. And so obviously the program didn't do me any good. I went because I figured they enjoyed my company, I guess. I read the Odette book a little while, and then every once in a while, you know, in that book it says if you thoroughly follow this program or something about the program. In fact, I just read the one for today. I think it's today's that even says that. And after it said about the program, I would turn my mind off because it never really said the program is this and this and this in so many words to me. So I couldn't see any reason why I should read that. I wasn't getting anything out of it anyway. So I quit. I didn't get a sponsor, but when I heard them talk about sponsors, I thought, oh gosh, what if somebody asked me to be their sponsor? Isn't that the height of it? And of course, obviously, nobody did. You can't give away something you haven't got. And So it was quite a while of just toying with the program and not really accomplishing it or making anything work. And I finally had another crisis. We had another crisis in our marriage, and I decided that, well, I was a psychiatric nurse at the time. I worked 17 years in that before I retired last year. And I decided that I had two choices. I had seen a lot of happy people at Al-Anon meetings, and I had seen people come in to the hospital and not be so happy, and it took them a long time to get over it. And I thought, well, I can either go to a psychiatrist, and that'll cost me an arm and a leg, and I really didn't want to do that. And then I couldn't work there anymore. You know, I weighed all this stuff over in my mind, and I thought, well, people are finding help in Al-Anon. Maybe I better just get going in Al-Anon. So this is what I did. I picked out a meeting close to my home, one that was convenient for me in the evening that I could go to every week, and couldn't find any excuse to miss it. And this is what I started doing. And then I heard them say, getting phone numbers of people who you can talk to when you need to, getting a sponsor, I got two. Reading the ODAT book, and of course I started reading the book, having meditation, all those things. The funny thing was, I had heard them say before that you should get people's phone numbers too so that you could call them. And one day when I was really upset and I was pacing the floor around home, I thought, well, I've got to call somebody, I've got to talk to somebody. And I knew Mary and Alice and Helen and all these first names, you know, and doggone, none of them are in the phone book that way. And I didn't, of course, even if I knew their last names, they're not in the phone book that way either. So I decided maybe I better listen to what they're saying and start doing some of the things they're telling me to do. And I got a whole bunch of phone numbers so I could call people, got some sponsors, and started working the program. Started using the steps. They told me the steps were basic to the program. And I started using those steps, and they are basic to the program. Without the steps, we would be nothing, really. I have become a big advocate of the steps, and I want to tell you about a few of them that have been particularly meaningful to me. I had a real hard time with the first step. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Well, there was no way I was going to be powerless over anything. I had tried a long time to control alcohol, and I finally realized I couldn't control what he drank, where he drank, why he drank, how much he drank, what it was going to do to him when he drank, or any other thing that had to do with it. But I had an awful hard time really accepting the fact. I could admit that I was powerless over alcohol, but to really accept it was not easy. And the other half of that step, about your life being unmanageable. My life was not unmanageable. I was the one that was handling everything. I was the one that was raising the children. I was paying the bills. I was doing the income tax. I was, you know, all this great stuff to prove that my life was not unmanageable. But then you come to the second step where it says something about insanity or about sanity, restoring me to sanity. And, of course, here I'm the psychiatric nurse. And that one, that was the step that got me into the first step. Because all of a sudden I realized I was worse than some of my patients, worse than most of my patients. I got to the point where I could not write my name without my hand shaking so badly that I couldn't control it. I had a hard time working. As long as my mind was occupied with what was going on at work, I was okay. But if I even went to the restroom and was alone that long, I was a mess again. I just fell apart. So I realized I was as bad as my patients. And so that sanity part in the second step is what got me to the first step that said my life was unmanageable. It was when I realized that I was close to insanity, that I was unmanageable. The fourth step is another one that is one of my favorites. It's the one I dreaded more than any other step. When I read those, I thought, well, those are for AAs. You know, they're not for us. And I never heard anybody in Al-Anon talk about them. And I thought, surely that's not something that I have to do. You know, and I just dreaded having anybody say that this had to be included. Well, it was like when I was in nurses training. We had a supervisor in surgery that everybody was scared to death of, and I really dreaded working in surgery and having class under her. And I thought, well, somehow they're going to put out some kind of a memo that says all nurses don't have to go through the surgery experience. And they didn't, and I did. And the same thing was true with the fourth step. I thought, well, the New York office is going to send out a memo and say, Al-Anons don't have to do the fourth step. And they didn't. And I did. And I found out that the fourth step really was a good thing for me. Because, obviously, I did not know myself. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I thought. I didn't know how I felt. I didn't know why I was doing anything. And the fourth step pointed myself out to me. And one of the things I particularly thought about in doing that was my motives for doing things. Why was I so angry? Why? I mean, not just the little situation, but why was I resentful? And a lot of it just boiled down to the fact that I was afraid I was going to lose control. I wanted to be able to control every situation, and if I couldn't control it, you know, it wasn't going to work right. So the fourth step was really meaningful to me because I just didn't know myself before then. I remember at one time we even heard an AA speaker who said that if you don't take the fourth step, you're not going to make a program. He said something to that effect, and, you know, I kept hoping John would hear this, and I'd kind of remind him of it periodically. But then it turned out that I had to myself, and it's just as important, I think, for Al-Anons as it is for AAs. I find a lot of people in our groups in Indianapolis who have not done it, who kind of discuss the steps from the fringes and don't realize how important they are, and I do think they are fantastically important. I like cartoons, and I especially like the Lockhorns. I don't know if you're familiar with the Lockhorns, but I saw one of the Lockhorns one time, and you know, they have situations right down in your own family. But she was screaming at her husband, and she says, "I am not nagging. I'm just trying to correct some of your 4,535 faults." And this is the way I always had been. I was always trying to correct some of John's 4,535 faults. And I didn't realize I had some faults of my own. The 11th step is another one that has been a good one for me and a big and important one for me. You would think that being a minister's wife, you'd have a direct channel up there, you know. But I kind of left that to John. I'd always been active in the church. I was raised in the church. When I was in nurses training, I went to church when very few of the others did. But I don't know, somehow after I got married and he was religiously oriented, I kind of let him take that part of the deal over. And I didn't have a meditation every day. I didn't make a relationship with my higher power important to me. So it's only through this program that I've realized that I need a meditation. I kind of Well, you know, when John preaches, he wears this long black robe, comes down to the floor, you know. And I always kind of had this vision in my mind that someday he would be flying off to heaven with this long black robe behind him, and I'd be sitting on the robe. And that was how I was going to get there. Nothing that I had to do. He's going to get me there, see? Well, thank goodness for this 11th step, because it taught me that it's not up to John. It's up to me to have a relationship with my higher power. And that has been very helpful to me. There have just been so many things like that that maybe you think are obvious things. But gee, I always tell newcomers now, there's so much that just takes so long to get into your thinking. You know, it has to kind of come in by osmosis. You have to hear things over and over and over and then start working them, and eventually it becomes a part of you. And it's taken me so long for so much of this to become a part of me. As I told you, I worked in psychiatry 17 years, and we had a lot of alcoholic patients, and especially wives of alcoholics, families of alcoholics. And I would always make it a point to talk with them. I was the only nurse there who could really relate to these people. And it was really a good thing, because it always made my program more meaningful to me when I could pass it on to somebody else. As far as I know, there's only one doctor that finally realized that I was connected with Al-Anon. And I don't know if the others realized, the other psychiatrists realized it or not, or if they just tried to handle everything under the guise of depression, which is what so many of them do. But this one doctor started referring some of his patients to me, and after I retired a year ago, he has called me several times and told me about a patient that he had that really needed Al-Anon. And it's been a really neat thing. A constant 12th step, which has really been good for me too. And I was just delighted to think that at least there is one psychiatrist who understands that there's something that he can't handle, and maybe somebody else is better equipped to handle it. There are a lot of tools that I learned in Al-Anon. Of course, the steps, very important. The Serenity Prayer is very important to me. The slogans, a day at a time, is one that I have to really work hard at. I'm one of these people who always appears calm on the outside, and inside I'm several days ahead. I can wake up in the morning and have my day all live before I ever hit the floor. In fact, sometimes I tell John in the morning, well, I can go through the day, whole day, without even thinking. I've thought it all through. It's all done. And so I really have to work at living a day at a time and taking it easy. There's another cartoon that I like. It's one of Ziggy. And Ziggy is sitting at his desk with a calendar and some papers in front of him. And he says, I believe in living one day at a time. Right now, I'm up to November 15th, 2063. And this is the story of my life. I carry that one around in my ODAT book as a constant reminder. I'm always days ahead. And I don't want to be that way. I want to keep it down to a day at a time. I have difficulty doing this. There are always some things that we have to work at harder than others, I guess. And that's one of my things. I have been on some heart medication for several years now. because I was having some irregularity of my heartbeat, and also last summer I'm having a little flare-up of this and palpitation and stuff, and so I thought, well, I'll go to the doctor. And I went to him, he said, are you drinking more coffee and tea and Cokes and stuff like that? And I said, no, none at all. He said, well, are you putting more pressure on yourself? And I said, oh, no. And I got home and I thought, oh, my gosh. You know, I didn't even realize. I was putting pressure on myself. Those things that we do to ourselves affect us. This affects me in a negative way. And I have to learn to use these slogans and use this program in order to keep my body in control, my life in control, everything in control. So I'm really working hard at doing that. The let go and let God is a slogan that I always had trouble with. It just is not definite enough for me. You know, let go of what? Let God what? You know, it's got to be more concrete than that for me. And I said that one time in a meeting. I just could not get anything out of that slogan. A lot of people said that was their favorite, you know. So one day somebody said to me, why don't you say, let go and let God be God? And I thought, oh, that really does it. Stop trying to be in control. Let God be God. Let God take control. And so this slogan has meant a lot more to me since I've been able to put it in this context. And now sometimes I'll say to myself, when I get stewing about something, you know, it all goes on in here, in this crazy thinking that goes on. But I'll get stewing about something and I'll think, let go and let God handle it. I always have to add something else, not just let go and let God, but let God handle it. Let go and let God be God, or however it works best for me at the time. Lately I've been saying, let go and let God handle it. And that really helps me. There is a slogan, be good to yourself, too. And to me this is not going out and getting a new outfit. To some people, maybe it is. Not to me. To me, being good to myself is doing things that will give me serenity, things that will help my relationship with other people, things that will help my relationship with my higher power. And these are the things that I have to do in order to be good to myself. And I try to do those things. John and I have a beautiful relationship now that we're both working our programs. I like to think of him as my best friend, and he really is. We're very close. We discuss a lot of things. There was a time when we said, well, we can talk anything over with each other, and I think in the back of my mind, well, he may say a lot of things, but there's a lot of stuff that I am afraid to say to him. And there was a lot of stuff I didn't say because I was afraid to. The funny thing is, while I was working in psychiatry, they started a lot of group therapies for the patients, and they asked me to lead the assertiveness training group. Can you believe this? Somebody who couldn't even vote. So I'm leading the assertiveness training group, and I had to do a lot of practice and study to do this, of course. But it was the most helpful thing in the world for me. I learned how to be a little bit more assertive. I learned how to even talk with John and tell him something that was bothering me. I never could do that before. It's funny how so many things in all areas of my life are helping me work my program. My program is helping me in all these other areas of my life. They go hand in hand. And now I feel like it's real easy to sit down and with John and say, something's really bugging me, John. I got to get this out. I never would have said that before. Never, ever. Next week, Friday, I am taking a trip to Florida for a week. There were four of us psych nurses who retired about the same time, and we'd been getting together every month for a game of euchre. So one of them built a home in Florida. She's a widow, and so she's spending the winter down there. So the rest of us in October, when we got together, she said, well, you know, about January will be my time to be hostess for the group, so you'll have to come down to Florida to meet with us. And we said, okay, just like that. Well, you know, after this was all planned, I thought, gosh, I've never gone off and left John. How's he going to get along without me? How am I going to get along? You know, all this kind of stuff. He had gone to conferences. He had gone to things, you know, away from home overnight. But I had never done it since he'd been sober. And I thought, oh, gosh, I don't know about this. And I got home and told John about it. And, of course, he's heard about it off and on now since October. And the response I got was, his lower lip goes down to his shoe. And he says, what am I going to do? You know, and I can get sucked into that so easily. I thought of ways I could get out of going. I thought of all kinds of stuff I could do so I can stay home and take care of my poor man. And cook for him and all these things, you know. And then I thought, well, this is ridiculous. This is just ridiculous. I should be able to detach well enough and let him take care of himself for a week. You know, and so I went ahead with my plans and all this stuff, and it's just the last probably 3 days that John has said, you know, I think maybe it's going to be all right when you go. I think I'm going to be okay. I might even enjoy it. First he was telling me he was going to Acapulco. And I said, not without me. But now he's planning to stay home, and he'll be okay. And I know he'll be okay. There are new things that come into our life, even when you're in the 60s. New things come in. New experiences, new challenges come. And they have to be handled, each one separately. We talk in the program about a higher power. And I've always thought of my higher power as being God. I've always believed in God, as I said before. But I know a lot of people don't, and I thought, you know, about this expression that we use of higher power. And I'm trying to figure out in my own mind what a higher power is to me. Higher, of course, is something bigger and greater than I am. And power, gosh, that's just an action word, really. It's action. It's strength. It signifies a lot that I am not able to do. For instance, there are a lot of things I don't understand. A lot of scientists have figured out some things, but there are some things I doubt if they'll ever figure out. And if they do, okay. But I know there are some things they will never be able to do. One thing that I think about frequently is that I pop a vitamin pill in the morning, vitamin and minerals. You know, this little pill goes in my body. And all the little parts of it know just which part of the body to go to. There's no way I could control where the parts of it go. I think about the sun coming up in the morning. No way I could control that. The earth rotating, all these things. No way I could manage that or even figure it out in the first place. I can plant an acorn and a tree comes up. I plant another little seed and a carrot grows. God has figured all those things out. That's far and above my imagination. Another one that baffles me is the fact that, you know, we're all standing upright here. We've got a daughter in Saudi Arabia. She's over in the other side of the globe, And she doesn't know it, but she's hanging by her feet upside down. You know. Figure that one out. There's got to be a higher power. There has got to be a higher power. Also, one of the biggest things, I think, I know all of you who are Al-Anons shed a lot of tears, a lot of tears. And I know a lot of, well, you alcoholics went through a lot of misery. It is fantastic that we are all here smiling, happy, well-dressed, beautiful people. Only a higher power could bring that about. No other way. I think attitudes are also terribly important. It's not what goes on outside of me as much as what goes on inside of me. The attitude I take toward what goes on outside that is really important. I believe I have to have an attitude of gratitude, because if I have that, everything kind of falls in place. And the things that aren't going quite so well don't seem quite so big. One thing I do, you might think I'm crazy, but one thing I do to help my attitude sometimes is I get up in the morning and I smile at myself in the mirror. You know, it's awfully hard not to smile back. And it really gives you a good feeling, you know, to see somebody smiling at you first thing in the morning. Try it sometime. It really does work. We had quite an experience coming here on the airline. We were scheduled on Piedmont through Charlotte, and the plane was so delayed, and then it was finally canceled, and we came on Eastern through Atlanta. But we had so much, we'd gotten to the airport in Indianapolis too early in the first place. So while we were waiting around there in the airport, there was a shoe shine place, and John says, I'm going to have my shoes shine. Well, I was wearing some boots, and I thought, well, I'd just have my boots shine too, so I did. And the shoe shine fellow had a little pin on him, a little gold, just little gold words that said attitude, and that was all it said. So we asked him about that, and asked him if that was to help his attitude, and he says, he kind of laughed, and he says, no, I got a good attitude. I don't have any problem with that. That's for other people. And we proceeded to talk about how some people come in with pretty bad attitudes, you know. Well, we waited around, and after about an hour and a half in the airport, I walked back to the shoeshine boy again, and I said, I just came back to see that pin of yours again. I wanted to look at that attitude. And then every once in a while I'd look down at my shiny boots and I'd think, attitude. Even on the plane, I'd look at those shiny boots and I'd think, it's all in the attitude. And that's a really neat thing, because it really is. You know, it's how you look at things. So it didn't matter if we got here 4 or 5 hours later than we were supposed to, you know. We got here. I have one other, another slogan that I kind of like too is misery is optional. I was pacing the floor at home one day, and I had done a lot of worrying and stewing around that day, and I walked into the bedroom, and here on the dresser, John had a little calling card, size card that he'd had there for 150 years, and I had looked at it many times. And I had never seen it before like I saw it that day. And all it said on it was, misery is optional. And I thought, boy, how true. Misery is optional. I don't have to be miserable if I don't want to. It's all in what's going on inside my head. It comes from inside again. It's an inside job. And then I have another little slogan that I like, which is, just my own, it's not one of ours also, but it's one that I use a lot too. And it's not really a slogan, it's from a song of Barbara Streisand's, It's Not Going to Rain on My Parade. And I use this one a lot, and this has nothing to do with the weather, you know. It has something to do with attitude. I can have a parade no matter what's going on around me. I can have a good day no matter what kind of a day you decide to have. And that's purely up to me. So I try to keep this in front of me all the time too, that it's not going to rain on my parade. So I'll just leave you with one thought too. Don't let it rain on your parade. Thank you.